So it is our great honor today to introduce and welcome Professor David Heberman. Professor David Heberman did his PhD at the University of Chicago in 1984, and currently he is the professor, Department of Religious Studies, and the department chair for Religious Studies. His book, Journey Through the 12 Forests, received the American Academy Award for Excellence in the year 1994. He has taught many courses, and recently he taught courses on religions of the East, Hinduism, religion, ecology and the self, living through nature, exploring a Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita. And we heard him this afternoon, amazing insights that he presented this afternoon from Patanjali Yoga and about yoga. So we are very, very happy to have him here. And the topic for this evening will be the Bhagavad Gita knowledge and love. We would like to welcome Professor David Heberman for this program by loudly chanting, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol.
Hari Bol. Is this working? Now it's working. So I've had many conversations since I saw you all last, and they've been delightful conversations. Saying to some that I'm even feeling my jet lag more than I was earlier this morning, but let's see if I can make sense of something here. So I wanted to talk about knowledge and bhakti, or knowledge and love, and in some sense I want to put them both together. And I was thinking how the relationship, thinking about the relationship between knowledge, gyan, and bhakti, is not unrelated to what I was speaking about this morning, how emotions are seen. Because I think all of these issues are tied together in a particular fashion. And one of the major questions out of Vedantic traditions is knowledge the highest path? Is jnana bhakti, or jnana marg, path to follow, or is bhakti marg the path to follow? And that within the Vaishnava or the Vedantic traditions, there seems to be a bit of a debate on that particular issue between Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedantic tradition and really all the Vaishnava Vedantic traditions. For Shankaracharya, he recognized the value of bhakti, but for him, finally, bhakti was to be surpassed and left behind in the ultimate realization of the highest knowledge. So that for him, knowledge was the ultimate level of understanding, and bhakti was really penultimate, was just down from that. The bhakti theologians completely reverse that, disagree with that, and understand knowledge as being very valuable. But finally, knowledge is the springboard into the ultimate realm of bhakti. And so I would like to think about that relationship with you a bit this evening, using the Bhagavad Gita as a way to do that. There are texts that, in a sense, are feeding the conversation that we see going on in the Bhagavad Gita. And I want to make some references to other Vedantic texts, Upanishadic texts, in thinking about that. One of the pictures of reality of Krishna that we get in the Bhagavad Gita is a two-dimensional one. Referring to it earlier today, in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is identified with Prakriti. There is already the fact that we see Krishna identified with both Prakriti and Purusha shows the synthesizing nature of the Bhagavad Gita, for Krishna is everything. Right? Again, the seventh chapter says so clearly, Vasudevaha Sarvam, that Krishna is everything. And Maharaj was explaining this morning that what someone called the inferior reality, superior reality, everything is Krishna, however we label those. Those two dimensions of reality are called in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the para prakriti and the apara. Apara is what's often translated as the lower nature of Krishna, and it does include more what we would identify with the stuff of the world, the material nature of the world, where the para prakriti is that which transcends it. So already there, we have an understanding of Krishna, or if I can use a term, of ultimate reality that is two-dimensional. One is the manifest world, and is called in the seventh chapter the vyakta level of reality, that is the manifest world that we can experience with our senses. And the para prakriti is identified with the avyakta, the unmanifest, unchanging dimension of reality. So these are two dimensions of reality that are expressed in texts that go back to the Vedas. The Purusha Sukta of Rig Veda is in many ways a very foundational text for later Vaishnav thinking about the nature of reality. In the Purusha Sukta, that's where we encounter Purushas having 1,000 heads, 1,000 arms, that gets divided, and we're actually even told the fractions of division in the Purusha Sukta. And we're told that Purusha is divided, and it seems as though in many ways that's how it all came to be within within Vedantic understandings of reality. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says, in the beginning there was the One, but the One was lonely and bored, and therefore split itself into a male and female, and in the interaction of the male and female, the whole world was produced. And so there's that sense that somehow reality is simultaneously one and simultaneously divided. I think there's the brilliance of the Achintya Bheda Bhed philosophy. And I think that this phrase that is at the very foundation is the call word of Gaudiya Vaishnav philosophy. Achintya Bheda Bhed is brilliant and should be applied to every aspect of our thinking, every aspect of our life. And it comes from this root. So going back to the Purusha Sukta, in that text we're told that one quarter of Purusha produces all this, all animate beings and all inanimate substances. One quarter of Purusha came to that. But three quarters rose up into that unmanifest, undetectable, if we call it transcendent, dimension of reality. So there already in this early Vedic text, we have those two notions. Yay. So delightful to have Srinathaji's darshan here. I don't get that often in many temples, and I'm a great fan of Srinathaji also, so it's nice to have that. And I must say, Maharaj made me so happy today. Maybe he has disappeared. I spent there's the man who's made me so happy again and again and again. I spent more than 4 years living in the Radharaman Mandir in Vrindavan and feel very, very attached to Radharamanji. And today, out of the blue, Maharaj delivers a picture larger than I am of Radharamanji. So what great darshans I'm having here. Back to the philosophical story that I want to talk about here. So two dimensions of reality already established in this foundational text, the Purusha Sukta. I am a scholar, I read scholarly literature, and I think about these things a lot. There was a great Bengali philosopher by the name of Surendranath Dasgupta, who wrote a 5-volume book on Indian philosophy. And in his section on Vaishnavism and the Panchatantra system, he made a statement that the Purusha Sukta is the foundation stone of all Vaishnav philosophy. And when I read that passage, I thought, what a reductionistic statement. How could he even say such a thing? But somehow over the years, I've come to think that in many ways he is right in thinking about the philosophical foundation. So I want to talk a bit more about that. For that text already gives us this complex nature, complex understanding of the nature of ultimate reality, that it has two dimensions, the form and the formless, the manifest and the unmanifest, the changing and the unchanging. And that becomes, I think, in many ways, the foundation of much Vedantic thinking. So if I move to a text that now is reflecting on that, the oldest, the largest, and in many ways, I would say, the most important of the Upanishads, I would turn to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. When I read the works of the Vrindavan Goswamis, Rupa Goswami, Jiva Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, the texts that they are often quoting are Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and Chandogya Upanishad. These are continue to be foundational texts for the thinking of the Vaishnav traditions that moves into the period of the Vrindavan Goswamis. What the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says is that Brahman has two dimensions, the Murta and the Amurta, and goes on to say that the Murta, that is that form, again, the dimension of reality that we can experience with our senses, is changing. That is, that it is ever new, that it is nava, that is transitory in that sense. That doesn't mean that it's unreal, as Shankara's school of Advaita Vedanta would claim. It just means that it's changing. And the other dimension of reality that identifies the amurta reality is unmanifest and unchanging. So that when I'm teaching this to my students who know a whole lot less about Vedanta than you do, my students in America, I try to give them a simple way of wrapping their mind around this understanding that reality is both changing and unchanging at the same time. And what I say is that they should just think about the double meaning of the simple phrase, nothing ever remains the same. So nothing ever remains the same because things are always changing. That is what Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is calling the Murta dimension of Brahman. Right? Things are always changing, never remaining the same. So nothing ever remains the same. But what is it that ever remains the same? It is nothing. And nothing is that dimension of Brahman that is identified in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad as Amurta. Right? So nothing ever remains the same. So as we move into the Bhagavad Gita, we've already encountered these two dimensions of reality in the 7th chapter in the discussion of the nature of prakriti with the para and apara. The para is actually identified with the amurta or avyakta dimension of reality, and the apara, the what is translated as the lower nature of Krishna, is identified then with the murta level of reality. So basic Vedantic thinking. The Bhagavad Gita continues that, but it adds another very, very important dimension of reality. And to move there, I want to go into the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which begins with a question about three technical terms. What is the Adibhuta? What is Adyatma? And what is the Adidaiva? And Krishna supplies the answer to Arjuna. And what he says is that the Adibhuta reality is the Kshara dimension. That is, it is the world. It is the changing world. So the world that we experience, or Jagat, to use another term, is fully real within the Vaishnav Vedantic understanding. Another point of difference between the Vaishnav Vedantic systems and Shankara's Advaita Vedant, that the world is declared to be real. In fact, I think that that is the true reading of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, actually in the 16th chapter, makes the statement that the teaching that the world, that the Jagat is asat, is unreal, is demonic, is asuric. Right, so that that there's that first dimension of reality that we have seen in other Vedantic texts. Right, so that is the Adibhuta level of reality. The adhyatmic level of reality moves us into that other dimension. It is declared to be Akshara Brahman. And Akshara is the unchanging, is the unmanifest dimension of reality. Right, so we begin with that. But very, very importantly, there is yet that other term, the Adidaiva. And how is Adidaiva defined? It is defined as Purusha. Going back to the Rig Vedic Purusha Sukta, it is the source of those other two dimensions of reality, and it's that which encompasses them. But I think it is so, so much more. Later on, in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, once again, we're told that in the 15th chapter that there are two dimensions to Purusha. There are two types of Purusha. There is the Kshara and the Akshara. There's the two again. But somehow, and it says, and yet, there is a dimension beyond both of those, and I'm sure that many of you know what's coming next, and that is called Purushottama. Purushottama. And it is with Purushottama that I want to stress that the relationship within bhakti then really becomes possible. Because in a sense, Purushottama is the simultaneity of form and formlessness. And maybe even more important, it is the form that allows the very intimate and particular relationship that the love affair of bhakti is all about. So I want to then think about those three terms and those three dimensions of reality as we move into the 11th chapter, which is such a great chapter, a very a great revelation happens in the 11th chapter, right? To do that, I want to talk about knowledge a bit more, gyan, because the Bhagavad Gita has a great deal to say about gyan. The second chapter says much about gyan. And I would want to suggest that in a way, gyan is very important. Gyan gives us some sense of the absolute nature of reality. That is important for the love affair of bhakti. I want to say more about that in a moment. But I want to suggest, and somehow coming out of conversations I've had today, that to say that that part of bhakti is having knowledge of absolute reality is quite different than saying that we can have absolute knowledge. Because when we're talking about ultimate reality, we're talking about the infinite. We're talking about something that is so much larger than us. Maharaj was talking about the place of humility as foundational in the life of bhakti. And I would agree. I often say to my students that humility is the foundational virtue in every aspect of our lives. And humility applied to knowledge means that we have to humbly accept that as the limited beings we are, We can never know ultimate reality absolutely, right? It is the infinite. And as the Bhagavad Gita say, we are amshas of Krishna, but we are not Krishna. Krishna is beyond us. In the Ras Leela that is celebrated on Sharad Purnima, just when the gopis think that they have Krishna, whoosh, he disappears, right? We cannot completely contain Krishna. That would be a spiritual arrogance that would be most dangerous. But to say that we can't have absolute knowledge is not saying that we can't have knowledge of the absolute. We can have some knowledge of the absolute. We're going to have it filtered through our own particular mind that has been conditioned by certain things. So we are going to see that ultimate reality differently than other human beings. And that's just fine. Achinta Bheda Bhed is a celebration of unity and difference. And that's what makes it interesting. But it is also achintya by nature. It is inconceivable. Having said that, gyan is important. Gyan, what does gyan actually give us? Gyan gives us two things, I would suggest. It tells us who we are, and it tells us something very important about the nature of ultimate reality. It tells us that our ultimate nature is Atman, is somehow that we are part of the eternal infinity. We are a part of that, right? So it teaches us something about our own self, and it also teaches us something about the nature of reality. And what it most clearly teaches is that reality is one. Everything is interconnected. Everything, to put it in the terms of the Krishna theology of the Gita, everything is Krishna. But again, that means that there's something ultimate in everything. Otherwise, we miss what it is. When we think of ordinary human relationships, what is it that kills a relationship? A love story, in a mundane love story, a typical love story. Most love stories about how the lovers get together and then they are separated, and the rest of the story is how they get together. But when they actually get together, and this moves into probably where the story ends, but in ordinary life, when two people get together, they often then lose each other. The love fades. Why does it fade? It fades because the lovers become bored with each other. But boredom is dependent upon the assumption that we know the other person. If we know the other person, oh yeah, I've been there before, then that's precisely when we lose the other person. In bhakti, we're talking about a relationship with the person, with Purushottama, with the highest person. And by definition, the highest person is part of, it is the biggest, is that infinite, right? So knowledge becomes very important for that. With that as a background, now I would like to move into the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And I think you all know the text well, but I want to just look at the drama. 11th chapter is a very dramatic chapter in many ways. And the scene opens with Arjuna asking Krishna to show his Vishwarup, his universal nature, to him. Now that already is an advance, because we can assume whatever Arjuna is, he's great. He is the human character who asks the questions that we want to ask, because he doesn't get it. Whether he gets it or not, it's important that he asks those questions so that we get it. That's really what's going on there in many ways. And he assumes that Krishna is his chariot driver. He knows him. He's his friend. He wrestles with him. He sits next to him. They play together. They eat together. There's kind of an intimate relationship. And he knows who Krishna is, but does he? And as Krishna begins to reveal more and more about himself through the teaching, Arjuna begins to have a sense, I don't know him at all. I don't know him at all. So the 11th chapter opens with Krishna being requested by Arjuna, please show me your universal form. And Krishna does that. In a sense, Krishna takes his mask off, a mask that is very familiar to Arjuna, that mask that Arjuna thought somehow defined Krishna totally. Krishna takes that mask off, and what does Arjuna see? He sees the infinity of beings that is Krishna, right? The infinity of beings. Well, but let's think about that a bit more. If he is seeing everything, and that's really what the Gita says, that he sees everything in arrayed before him, ekastha, in a single place. He sees the totality of reality somehow before him. And although the Gita does give a kind of description to what he sees, I want to think about that a bit more. What that might look like. What that might even sound like. You know how human perception works. Right here in my hands is white light. And yet it's completely invisible. I'm sure you've had an experience with a prism. If I hit a prism, and this would work better obviously if we're out in the sun with good strong white light there, I could split that light into a variety of colors. And then we could perceive red, green, yellow, and the other colors, right? That's how perception works. We can't see everything at once. We can really only see one thing at a time to a certain degree, right? It has to be separated out a bit for us. So what I'm suggesting is in that seeing everything simultaneously, Arjuna is seeing nothing. And in fact, the Bhagavad Gita in the 11th chapter says he has a realization of Akshara Brahman. That's really where knowledge, that's where knowledge goes, right? If I wanted to play with the perception a bit more and think of sound, back in the time that Maharaj writes about in his early travels, early 70s was a very interesting time, probably everywhere on the planet, but in the United States it was a time of some loud rock and roll. And I don't know what you know about the groups, but Bruce Springsteen was very popular in the early 1970s in the USA. And when I was in college at that time, I went to a Bruce Springsteen concert. And because I went with students from New Jersey, the state that the singer is from in the U.S., I got third row seats with all of them, which was right up front in a big audience. And the thing about Bruce Springsteen fans, when they would go to his concert, they all knew his songs and they all sang along when he would sing his songs. There was a moment in the concert when he was singing, everyone in the audience was singing very loudly, that I went from hearing many sounds to hearing no sound at all for just a short period. And I talked to a physicist later on and described this experience and said, you know, what do you think was going on? And he said, if you get enough sound waves together, they can cancel each other out. Because again, we understand sound through articulation. If I could mix all the words that I've just spoken in the last 2 minutes into a single sound, you would make no sense of them. Right? In fact, that's one way of understanding the sound Om, that it is the closest sound that human beings can make to the totality of all sound. But if we could somehow hear the totality of all sound, we could hear nothing. So again, I think that's that's Arjuna's experience. His experience was everything at once there. And he says in the text, "Ah, now I understand." He's had an experience of Akshara Brahman. And there are many schools that would say, he's finished. We close the book, we're done. But very importantly, the Bhagavad Gita does not end there. For although Arjuna says, "Aha, now I understand who you are. Now I understand that my previous understanding was very limited." But Arjuna goes on to say, but he's very uncomfortable at that moment also. Because he even apologizes to Krishna. "Oh, if I only would have known, I would not have wrestled you." It's very much like the story I told earlier, where Yashoda Ma is looking into Krishna's mouth and sees the entire universe in the mouth of her small child, and her bhav connection with him is finished at that moment, right? And she apologizes. "Oh, if I only would have known, I wouldn't have hit you with a stick. I wouldn't have put you to bed without supper. I wouldn't have. But are these things really problematic? Arjuna begins to apologize to Krishna. "If I only would have known all of this, I wouldn't have been so intimate with you." And yet, as Maharaj pointed out earlier, it's precisely because Arjuna was Krishna's friend that Krishna reveals what he reveals to him. Is that really problematic? Is that intimate interaction with Krishna problematic? So Arjuna finally says, I can't connect with you. There's no experience possible. This would be like, in the image I was using earlier, of the drop returning to the ocean. That's what the experience of Akshara Brahman is at the end of the road would be. But Arjuna says, "No, I just can't connect with you." There's a desire for a relationship, a sambandh relationship. And so Arjuna then utters that famous request, "Return to me like a father to a son, as a friend to a friend, or as the beloved to a lover. Return to some kind of relationship with me so that I can have that loving connection with you." That's what he is seeking. Again, it is our nature that we don't connect with the universal or the infinite. Universal love is a grand idea. It is a beautiful kind of love, right? And so in no way would I want to devalue it. But universal love, love of all people, love of all beings, we know from our experience, is not the same as that intimate connection with another single person. That's where the loving connection becomes very strong, very powerful, from one being to another particular being. Right? One being to another particular being. So Arjuna says, "Return to that form that I knew so well." And at that point, Krishna puts his mask back on, if I can continue to use that image, to where Arjuna recognizes Krishna again. So he's ending up where he began, but he has gone through a kind of a double movement where something very, very important has changed for him. And what has changed for him that allows now a much, much deeper connection is an understanding of the true nature of Krishna. He had a friendship with him before. It was a beautiful friendship, but somehow it was limited. And to push it to the next level, he had to have that deep encounter with another perspective on reality. And that's precisely what jnana or knowledge provides. So that knowledge, again, is somehow certainly not the enemy of bhakti. It's not irrelevant for bhakti. But I'm suggesting that it is a powerful feeder for the higher experience of bhakti. But it is a springboard into the higher experiences of bhakti. It is not the end of the road itself. So that knowledge really serves bhakti to the degree that it helps us come to understand who we are. And that's stated in terms of Krishna bhakti is that we are Krishna dasas. Right, that we are servants of Krishna, or servants sometime, I think, is even a limited term. Often I've heard of Vaishnavas who like to translate das into English as a follower, but somehow connected to Krishna. Right, that is one's true nature, and Krishna is that ultimate reality. But again, an ultimate reality that is not perceived through some universal, abstract, impersonal way, but rather is connected with in a very, very particular form. And the term that the Bhagavad Gita uses for that, that is only used once in the 11th chapter, but I think is a very important term, is the term swarup. The term swarup, I think, is a very important concept that comes out of the Bhagavad Gita and has a lot to offer in thinking about the divine relationship. And swarup is a term that also has a double meaning in this regard. Swa means own, and rup is form. And it is the form that Bhagavan takes to reveal himself in a particular form to a particular devotee. So that's what it means from Bhagavan's side, right? That it is to use my image of the mask, it is the mask, so to speak. For Arjuna, Krishna was a chariot driver. I confess that I personally don't really think of Krishna as a chariot driver in my intimate relationship with Krishna. One of my dear friends, guides, teachers, hosts in the Radharaman temple, Srivats Goswami in Vrindavan, said to me when I first came to him as a very eager young student who knew very little about Hinduism back in 1980, and he sat me down, fed me some delicious prasad, and we entered into a conversation where he found out that I was there to learn something about Hinduism. And he said to me, you will never understand Hinduism until you understand that there are 660 million gods and that God is one. And he went on to explain that that for him meant that at that time there were 660 million Hindus living in India. And his point was that everyone has their own particular conception of God. It must be over 800 million gods now. And that God is one. Which is a very modern version of what we find in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad in the mouth of the great sage Yajnavalkya. When he was asked, how many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? And he says, 3,306. But the questioner pushed him farther. No, but how many really? I think he goes down to 33. How many really are there? He goes down to 4, 3, 2 finally. But how many are there really? Well, I think this is my favorite answer. 1.5. And then finally, he settles on 1. And that one. So that, again, there's that notion that it's achintya bheda bheda again. That that Bhagavan ekhi hai, zarur, right? That is a certainty. But this is the bheda bheda. It is not just simply a bheda. That we all of us, and this goes back to, I think, what I was saying about absolute knowledge. There's a lot of conflict in the world today. We have seen violence. We have seen people kill each other over religious differences. We've seen people kill each other. I come from Christian West, where for 100 years Catholics and Protestants fought each other over different creedal points. We believe this, and if you don't believe this, you die at the sword. I want nothing to do with that kind of violence. And I think what my good friend Srivats Goswami was telling me is there's no need for that violence if we understand we all have different dispositions. We're raised in different families. We're raised in different cultures. We've had different experiences in life. We're conditioned psychologically different. Therefore, we are going to conceive of God in a different fashion. Fine. That just makes the Leela all the more spicy. Right? Difference is good. Difference is good. As long as we realize that we're talking about the same reality. So the Swarup is that gracious move on the part of Bhagavan to come to a particular bhakta in a particular form. And the Swarup, from the human perspective, is my own deity, my own God. Back to that mamata. That's the Swarup. This is my form. If you are involved in what I call Swarup Seva or Murti Puja and have spent time in that Seva with a particular Swarup, you know that just the graceful moments of Bhagavan coming to you in a particular form, that form that Bhagavan takes to develop a particular relationship with you. For Arjuna, that was a chariot driver. I'm not a general in an army like Arjuna. I don't conceive of God in that way. Krishna doesn't come to me in that particular form. The way Krishna comes to me is really so dear to my heart, I'm not sure I would want to describe it, and it's not that relevant because he's going to come to you in a different form. And that's marvelous. That's marvelous. And it's in that interaction then with a particular form of Krishna. Whether it's Gopinath, Radha in this temple, or whether it's some Swarup in your home shrine, or whether it's some inconceivable form that I can't even myself think of now, Krishna comes to you if you open your heart in that very particular form. But Arjuna understood, although the very particular form for him was his chariot driver, he also understood that that particular form was non-different from Vasudevaha Sarvam, the totality that is Krishna. And that if we all could have that understanding, that the particular form of God that we conceive of, that we worship, that we enter into that gracious relationship with, is non-different from other conceptions that other people have, we would be living in a world of religious tolerance. And I think that is finally another direction in which humility takes us. So if a Swarup comes into your life, and I often say that the Swarup that came into my life seduced me. It's nothing I was looking for, but seduced me in a way that I just can't even imagine my life now without. The next move is to serve Bhagavan in that particular form. Serve Krishna in that form. That's really what seva is all about. And to develop that intimate relationship, that sambandha, that's what comes out of that. That's the fruit. It's not a fruit like, oh, if I do this seva to Krishna, I'll get a raise in my job, or I'll get a new car, or I'll get an A on exam. Like, okay, fine. I mean, if that's necessary, that's necessary. But there's something so much higher that just comes, and it's just the joy of that relationship with the particular Swarup that is non-different from the totality of all reality that comes to you. It's that sambandh, that loving relationship. And if one enters into that, I think with the gyan, if I can go back to that term, that Arjuna was taught in that important lesson, really taught in words back from the second chapter on, but then really taught in that powerful, revelatory way. If one can learn that lesson, one then understands that in worshiping one's swarup, one is worshiping the entire universe and beyond through that particular swarup, which leads to then the what many consider to be one. I'm not sure, certainly one way of expressing, and the Bhagavad Gita lays it out, one of the highest realizations that comes out of that, and that is Sarvatma Bhav, the understanding that Krishna is everything and everything is Krishna. So that it is in the worship of a very particular swarup that one can come to understand the totality of all of reality. And that is another one of the fruits that comes out of, I think, that kind of seva. So, yes, back to knowledge and bhakti, or knowledge and love. Are they enemies? If not enemies, I hope that the Bhagavad Gita and my words on it have made it clear that I think that is wrong thinking altogether. But is knowledge somehow higher than bhakti? Is bhakti higher than knowledge? I think what the Bhagavad Gita teaches is that knowledge is a vital component of bhakti. And as Urmila Mataji was saying earlier, that doesn't mean that somehow you have to like figure it all out, have high knowledge before beginning bhakti. By no means. Arjuna's relationship with Krishna began with whatever level of understanding he was operating with, right? Krishna revealed what he revealed because of that friendship. So that one plunges into that loving relationship. And again, that is the power of emotions, right? That it's an easier form of yoga. Meditating, trying to fix the mind on Brahman through just the mind alone is really difficult. How do you hold the mind? If you've had that experience, and it's good to cultivate that of the mind, but it's difficult to hold the mind. That's why it's called the monkey mind, where the emotions just, when you're in love with someone, you don't even have to try to think about them, try to be fixed on them, right? Smaran is just flows like an easy river with that kind of love. So Arjuna had that sort of relationship, and yet he understood that there were limitations in his relationship. And it's that knowledge of the higher nature of reality, that knowledge of understanding that his dear friend Krishna that he was already attached to was so much more than he ever imagined, that expanded that relationship so that the relationship continues. But Arjuna's attachment to Krishna, I would suggest, was so much stronger, so much more vibrant after that revelation than it was before. And again, that means in worshiping a particular form, it's attachment to that particular form, understanding that particular swarup that is coming to you is such a precious result of grace. But then not limiting that to some particular, like, oh, this is my Thakurji that is different from every other one. If I want to have darshan of Gopinath and Radha here, they are here in particular. If I want to have darshan of Radharaman, I have to get on a bus or a plane and get to Vrindavan. They're different swarups, but they are still the same Krishna. Right? They are still the same Krishna. So again, how to simultaneously enter into that deep loving relationship where one has a deep connection with a particular person, Purushottam, but Purushottam, and that is the Swarup relationship. The Swarup is Purushottama, not some ordinary form. It is Purushottama, that form that is simultaneously a form that is a limited in size and space, again part of the gracious move of that, and yet encompasses those two other dimensions of reality and supersedes them by unimaginable dimensions. That is achintya bheda bhed. And that's probably the first and last word that can be said on it all. So maybe that's a good point for me to end. Thank you. I don't know what your time is. I'd be happy to answer questions or hear what you have to say about this. I'm not in charge of time. I usually am, so I'm enjoying not being in charge of time while I'm here. But whoever is in charge of time, is there time for questions? Or I know that we've run, wasn't it originally to have ended around 8:30? Or am I right or wrong about that? Okay. And Darshan opens at 8:50. Okay. That's precise time. I like that. So we have time for one question, and here it is.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for such an elaborate presentation. It was wonderful. I wanted to ask, like, you have studied so many scriptures. You give such a deep and descriptive explanation. So, but you know, in Srimad Bhagavatam, we see these devotees in Vrindavan who seems to be oblivious of who Krishna is. And but Krishna, the Purushottama, is, you know, most surrendered to them. So is it, so what's your point point of view on that? Is it really important to understand and so, you know, bhakti so deeply, scientifically, or should it be practiced spontaneously?
Well, I think that's a great question. And in some sense, I don't think there's an easy answer to it. But what I would not want to suggest, so is another way of phrasing what you're saying, does one need to really have that deep understanding before engaging in bhakti, or can bhakti just come up spontaneously and you should enter into it? Well, if I had a choice of those two, I would go for the latter. Because I would not want to say that one has to sort of wait until you have some deep understanding before you enter into the relationship of bhakti. I think that kind of sequential understanding would be problematic. So again, of the choice, I would say the spontaneous. But if the spontaneous means that there's no room for knowledge coming in, if there's no room for knowledge, then I guess I would want to shy away from that one also. What I'm suggesting is that This is a path. Bhakti is a path, and it's an ever-expanding path. And as one walks deeper into it, ideally, rather than walking away from it, one walks deeper and deeper into a more intimate relationship. And that path is paved with stones of knowledge and stones of deeper love. There are spontaneous experiences. Satsang, we've all had it, being around, we've been in perhaps at a particular darshan or a kirtan, our hearts open. And those spontaneous heart openings are essential. I think in many ways they're acts of grace. It's hard to work on it. You can't really work on opening your heart. That is, I think, grace. And it happens to one. One wants to be open to that. So I would say that important stones that pave that pathway into a deeper relationship are stones of that kind of spontaneous heart opening. We want to soften our hearts. We want to have humble hearts so that can happen more frequently. I think we want to do that work. But I am also suggesting that just to think about, there's a place for gyan, there is a place for study of scriptures, there is a place for satsang with those who have thought about these things, with fellow bhaktas who have considered these sorts of things in ways we haven't. So I think that some of the stones on that path also are of gyan. And I think study of scripture is another form of satsang. It's a form of satsang where we're in communication with those who are not necessarily here in this particular time, but have a great deal to say to us. And I was suggesting that I miss more these kind of gatherings. I spend a lot of my time more in the satsang with those who live before. They're really both two different forms of satsang. So we get gyan from both. We get jnana from both. So I guess I want to say it's not either or, it's bheda-bheda. It's simultaneously two together. But by no means would I want to suggest that someone should feel like you have to kind of get all your jnana ducks in order before you plunge into the realms of bhakti. One of the statements I heard in Braj once was that Ram is very dharmic. He was kind of the dharmic Raja. And before you approach Rama, whether Ram Bhaktas agree with this or not, this is what I heard from a Krishna Bhakta, before you approach Rama, you really need to get your life in order, get your life straight, where Krishna himself is crooked. He is Bunky Bihari after all. And since he is crooked, we can approach him in whatever form that we have. So I think we to approach immediately, but understand that is finally a relationship that just goes on and on and on. A relationship with the infinite can't by nature have an end. So why not just gather up what you can as you move on that journey to make the relationship more and more intimate? I think it's time for darshan. So thank you all for your attention. Again, I've enjoyed being here with you all today.
Hare Krishna. So let us express our deepest gratitude to Prem Das Prabhu, Professor David Heberman, for that very analytical, deep and extremely inspiring presentation on trying to harmonize these both components of knowledge and love. It was definitely such an amazing explanation. I don't think I've really pondered over the depths of knowledge and love in such an amazing way. I don't think I'll ever forget that there are 660 million gods and how that one god can manifest in 660 million ways. So amazing to hear this explanation. So we are very grateful for that amazing presentation. Let us thank him very loudly by chanting, Haribo! Haribo! And Haribo! And what's so amazing about him is he's so scholarly, but he has such a soft heart of bhakti. When Radhanath Maharaj asked me to take the Radharaman picture up there, I took the picture of Radharaman in his room and he was practically dancing in ecstasy that Radharaman has come. And I was amazed to see someone who's so scholarly has a heart which is soaked in so much emotion of bhakti. It was very amazing to see the balance. So when he spoke about knowledge and love together, I think who better but him to speak about knowledge and love. Thank you, Prabhu. Hare Krishna.